everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. It's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as best-selling and award-winning interviews with writers of all genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. PNWA hosts a wonderful writers' conference every year where I have taught many times, as has today's guest, as a matter of fact. And it's a great conference, and it is open to all genres of writers, all ages of writers. And it takes place every July. Actually, no, it'll be moving to September, but it's this July still, but this coming 2017. And it'll be down in the SeaTac area between Seattle and Tacoma. So if you're anywhere in the vicinity and you want to go to a great writers conference, head on over to pnwa.org and check it out. I should also mention that if you have enjoyed the Fearless Writing series I do on this show, and I'll be doing another one, by the way, in 2 weeks. But if you've enjoyed that series, or if you enjoy any of the blogs I post regularly through Author Magazine, and if you live in the Seattle area, I will be teaching a Fearless Writing workshop on April 15th. Oh, tax day. Yes, it is. But Saturday, April 15th, from 1 to 5 p.m., enrollment is limited. Only about 10 people can come. So if you're interested in that, this is a Fearless Writing workshop to help you get into the frame of mind from which writing is possible. Get over all those emotional blocks that stand in the way of writing the book you most want to write. Fearless Writing. You can learn about that at williamknauer.com, my website, williamknauer.com. Well, I know a guy who's fearless. He has to be. He was a pilot for years. That would scare the bejesus out of me. But it didn't scare him. It's Philip Donnelly. I'm welcoming him back to the show. Philip is a best-selling author, suspense writer, and just an all-around nice guy. And he's always got something interesting to say. And I'm sure he's got something interesting to say because he's got a brand-new book out, number 7, Seconds to Midnight. Philip, welcome to the show.
Well, it's good to be here. Good to be back.
It's good to have you back. You got word, so it's today, March 14th. It's been a week since Seconds to Midnight was published. This is your seventh novel, your seventh Donovan Nash novel. So here's my question to you, Phil. What has changed about Philip Donnelly from that first book? How has it changed for you as a writer over the last, now that you've written, well, I know you've written 8, but the 7 that you've published?
Well, the process becomes less mysterious.
Does it?
When I first started out, I didn't know if I could write a novel. And then it turns out I maybe kind of could, but then I didn't think I could sell one, or that anyone would buy one rather than relatives. So
right.
It has evolved, thankfully, to the point where, you know, when I sit down to write a new book, I'm pretty certain it's going to be published, and more people than my mom are going to buy it. So that part, thankfully, has evolved. I don't know that the process has gotten easier with the series. I think in some ways it gets harder.
Yeah. Does it get harder because you – it's sort of like – I sometimes wonder if people who work on, like, sitcoms that go on for many seasons and have to keep finding the new exciting idea to keep that series fresh. Do you go through that with your series?
Well, I find because of the series and Donovan Nash, and he's kind of an interesting guy in that he heads up an organization called EcoWatch. And so they're a scientific research firm, and so they're kind of led out into the field by natural disasters. And so those are still out there. So there's always some trouble brewing somewhere for them to start in. But But I think what happens is for me the harder part is the character involvement, and you know, you can always blow stuff up because that's really what we're supposed to do when we write thrillers. So,
right.
but carving the characters and making them bigger and better, but you're constrained by, or I'm constrained by, everything that has come before. So that makes
right.
it a little more difficult as I go along. But
yeah.
So that's kind of the big question mark. It's not what disaster. It's like, well, how are my people going to grow or change or be changed?
And how often do those growths and changes surprise you? In other words, I'm sure you go in with some ideas, but how often do the characters do their own thing?
More and more. When I started writing, I felt compelled to pretty much know everything that was going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, the start point, the end point, and everything in between. As I got more comfortable with the process and my process, I would just sort of wing it, and then the surprises would roll in. Seconds to Midnight, especially. I had started, the way my publishing cycle works is I start writing June 1st is kind of just a target date that I like to be sitting at my computer somewhere, typically Montana,
right.
and I'm starting to write. And I did. This book was last year. I guess it was two summers ago. And I sat down to start writing, and I had the book in mind, and I wrote for a month and got the first 100 pages done and decided that the book I was writing was not the book that needed to come out next.
Ooh.
So
really?
I'd lost a month.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
I had problems, and
Just to briefly interrupt, your suspense writers, and suspense writers, generally speaking, really need a book. I mean, it's a book a year is kind of how it goes.
Right, right.
You just know
so
that, well,
I'm
I need
behind.
To take a year off, and it's got to come out.
Yeah, no, that doesn't happen.
Right.
But now I'm behind. And so
okay.
I have to put aside the book that became number 8 and
right.
think up something that is book 7. And so I figured it out. There were some ideas that I kind of had kept in a reserve, and I started dusting those off, and I had a beginning, and I had an ending, and I didn't have any of the middle part. So that that middle
that
300 pages is the part that I needed.
Yeah.
So it was, I had to laugh some days. It's like, I know why they call them mysteries, because the author doesn't know what's happening. And
but
so there was a
I'll
lot
tell
of
you.
Things that transpired.
But I think the surprises is, you know, I often write in short form. I do write book length stuff, but I write a lot of shorter stuff. It's nice 400 and 500 word pieces. But I make
right.
sure mentally when I'm beginning the piece to sort of leave room for a surprise. Even though I might say I want to write about this one idea, you know, in 400 words is over pretty quick. It's 4 or 5, you know, paragraphs. But I make sure to not think I have it all sewn up in my head, because somewhere a surprise is going to come. One sentence is going to lead to a thought I didn't have. And that, for me, is usually the best stuff, the surprise, the thing that the inspired thought that just popped
right.
into my head. I try to leave room for it, because I can block it out thinking I got to know everything because I got to get this done, so on and so forth. So I like the surprises myself.
I do too, and you're right. They have, and if you listen close, your characters will tell you where they want to go.
Yeah.
And I've been involved with my characters for a long time, and I know when I've written a wrong piece of dialogue, because it just sounds funny. It's like, well, no, she wouldn't say that. So there's everything that has come before, and that's. Sometimes most of my research comes from going back through my own novels and finding out what I wrote before.
Right. You do forget, don't you?
Uh-huh.
Yes, you can. And so, you know, I would think, so I, you know, a big part of your biography is that you were a pilot for many, many years. And I know that I don't know many pilots, one of whom I know, Richard Bach, famously pilot and writer. But I know that when you fly, it's a pretty meticulous procedure in terms of, from what I understand, a very detail-oriented, checking everything off, skip no details, take no chances kind of process. Is that an accurate description of landing and taking off and landing a plane?
Well, it's the entire process. It's very, very structured. It's very detail oriented. You're right. If you want to grow up to be an old pilot, then yes, you adhere to all of those things.
Right. And so I would think, and that was a big part of your life, right? I mean, you must have been a very detail oriented guy to be able to do that.
You know, I did it for 30 years, and you know, you get. It becomes just a second nature, and I still have a lot of pilot in me. And so I had to laugh because I was, you know, I estimated how long it would take me to make the phone call to call you right on the money today. And some people call that OCD, but it's really a pilot thing.
Well, maybe for that alone, I could have been a pilot because I am so just incredibly on time. So maybe for that alone, but. So what I was getting at is, look, then you come to writing and, you know, you can't plan it all. You know, you have to be so willing to, even those people who outline, you've got to be willing to see what the heck happens. You know, you really can only plan so much. You can plan the life out of a piece, you know.
Exactly. But flying is also surprises too, unfortunately.
Yeah.
There are variables you can't plan for and you've got passengers to deal with, you've got weather, you've got mechanical problems, which were few and far between, but those things do happen, and then you have to, and then you react. And there is a limit to how much you can plan or how much you should plan.
Because it seems to me, I was talking to my son about this, who's a young man, 18, and he's worried about his future, and I said, you know, the best thing you can learn to do is to understand that whatever comes your way in life, you don't have to know all that's going to come, but you have to know that you have the wherewithal to be okay when something comes. And so even being a pilot, for all the details you have to check off, you have to know that if something comes up, you don't want to so rely on all those checks and practices to think that your instincts won't and your ability to handle the moment won't guide you also, right?
There is so much training, especially by the time you get into the jets and the simulators. It is it's pretty incredible the stuff they run us through every year in the simulator. You could never even hope to see a small fraction of that in a career. But when something does happen, you've been trained to the point where you just react. You're not afraid. It's just you've done it a million times. It's like, oh, look, the engine's on fire. Let's deal with that. And it's not quite that calm, but it is surprising what experience will do. And I think that applies to life in general. The older we get,
it does.
The less excited we get. And the more books you write, I think the less panicky I get that I'm going to end up in some kind of a box someplace I can't get out. So
that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the things I have to teach my students who haven't written books yet is that for people who have finished books, you know what you don't have to know. In other words, you don't panic about the stuff that you don't know yet, that you know will fill in as you write the thing. But it's easy, I think, for first-time writers to be overwhelmed by all that they don't know about the story as they begin writing it, thinking that, oh, my God, how am I going to solve this problem? What about this? What about that? But if you've written a book to the end, you understand that your job isn't to know everything before you start, that so much of it will come as you write it. And there's really no way to really understand that until you've finished a couple of them.
Exactly. I was watching an interview on TV. There was Phil Mickelson, the golfer, was being interviewed.
Yeah.
And golfers talk about that a lot. It's like once they won their first tournament, they knew how to do it.
Yeah.
And it's a big jump. It's a big mental jump. And I think writing is very similar to that, because you can take a lot of wrong turns and before you're published, and most of us, our first novel is not the one that shows up on the shelves first. It's the second or third one, and it is a process.
Yeah, you know, I always also say to my students is you've got to finish. You don't really know what the book is until you get to the end. You know, often then you have to go back and make the whole thing really come together. But for me, the ending is always where I learn why the thing was written. Really, even if it's a shorter piece, the ending is where I find the landing place for it. And now I really know what it is. And until you get to that, I don't think you really know what a piece is until you get that, really hit the ending. What is it? Where am I really headed? You know? You can't know.
That's exactly right. Yeah. When I write, I start at page one, and I never go back. I never look back.
Right.
I write the whole book. And when I get to the end, then and only then do I print it out. And so when I go back months later and open page one, then I know the whole story, and a lot of things change, a lot of the tone and a lot of dialogue, but I have to have something to edit first.
Right. Right. And how often do you get, it sounds like it really hasn't happened where you're rereading it and think, I made a hash of this. What have I done? It sounds like you've never had that big a rewrite, or has it happened? Where in the rereading you realize, oh my goodness, this isn't working.
Well, early on I started a book, and it was before I was published. It was probably the second book I had tried. I'd written the first one and was fortunate enough to get an agent out of that one. And then I went to work on what would be the second one. And I wrote 100 pages of just the worst stuff. I didn't know what I was doing or where I was going, and I kind of had forgotten what I'd learned writing the first one, and I just threw it out. I mean, I just threw it all out, and it was just awful. It was 100 pages of just garbage. And so it's like, slow down, take your time, and do it right, figure out where you're going. I learned early on it's very painful just to delete something like that.
But so, you know, you got to be – I think it's critical to learn – you got to learn how to write your books, and you got to learn to recognize something that isn't working. And the sooner you can be honest and recognize it, the sooner you can turn back and find the right path. You know, it might just be one scene that isn't working that you realize, this. I know what a scene that isn't working feels like, and I'm in one right now. So let's not pretend, you know, let's go and start this again.
If you're listening to your manuscript or to your characters, I think they tell you right off. There's kind of a cadence that exists that when I'm working and it's happening. And, you know, the minute that cadence kind of slips and I'm a little uncertain and the dialogue kind of tails off, I know right away that where I'm headed is not the right road. And so it's time to stop, take a walk, clear my head, figure out, you know, how far back how far back is the trail I need to be on?
Yeah,
and it's usually not that far. But you need to listen, I think. And there's a saying I really like. It's like, don't hang on to a mistake just because you took a long time making it.
Catch it
early, go back. You know, it's just
right.
You know, wipe dust yourself off and dig back in.
Man, I love that you use the word listen. I actually have a book coming out in May called Fearless Writing, and one of the chapters is called Writing is Listening. And I really think it is. When I found that, and you know why it was helpful to me, and I don't even write fiction anymore, but I know I first learned it in fiction because my characters would talk to me. But really, the best word I can use is the kind of where I set my attention is very much like the attention, like what I do with my attention when I'm listening, like to you as you're describing your writing experience. What I do with my attention while I'm writing is so close to listening, and really not. I can't use the word thinking. It's not an accurate for me word to describe what is happening in me while I'm writing. It is listening at its core, even though I'm alone.
I think so. Yeah. Well, yeah. It is. And I think it's – I'm very visual. So I'm picturing. I mean,
yeah.
I've created the scene in my head. And so and I can stop it, and I can move it around, and I can move around amongst the action and the characters, and I get a sense of what people would say or what needs to happen. So it's kind of the full immersion experience, and so you do listen and watch, and it helps all the logistics. I think I don't end up with very many logistical problems. There's a person called a proofreader that gets it at the very end. They are to words what accountants are to nickels. And they've called me out a few times. Person was right-handed, but then they're doing this with their left hand.
We're
finding that hard to believe. And so if you watch and listen while you're making it, then the proofreader doesn't have as much to yell at you about.
Well, that's nice. That's God bless the proofreaders. Yeah, I can't believe the little stuff mine caught me on, but that's what they're there for.
Cause
I'm not so detail-oriented like that. When I'm writing, I go quick, and I'm glad for those people who are checking every comma and every M-dash,
I know.
But listening also is the only way to know, like you said, to hear whether the character, is the character talking or are you making them talk, Because you can tell the difference.
Right.
Are you, forcing them into that career, or are they choosing it themselves?
Right.
You can just feel, you can hear, I think you can hear, as you said, you can really feel it. But it's an important thing to be able to learn. It's really the way, I don't know if it's true, in that you're a pilot, maybe you could tell me, but someone said that the way pilots get from, fly a plane from one place to another is really a process of constant correction. In other words, it happens very quickly, but just like a tightrope walker has to keep finding their balance as they cross the tightrope, the pilot is constantly getting back on course and back on course and back on course. They kind of drift a little bit. Is that true? I've heard this.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely true. I mean,
I think it's a great metaphor.
Yeah, and it's like driving your car too. I mean, it's just a series of corrections. If you stop making those corrections, your car will go somewhere you don't want it to, and the airplanes are the same way. If you're actually hand flying the airplane, only you're going to go in the wrong direction in three dimensions. So scarier.
But there are no in on the road. You've got those little bumps. They put between lanes sometimes, not always.
Right.
Where if you drive, you go bump, 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 bump. But up there in the sky, which is more like life, there are no lane bumps. You got to know what it feels like when you're drifting in your career, in your book, and whatever. Am I on course? Am I not? You got to know what it feels like one way or the other. I don't know how in the plane, but I know how I know when I'm writing it. I know what it feels like when I'm off course.
Yeah, there are perceptions and experience and a lot of ways. And again, the airplane will talk to you. About everything will talk to you if you learn how to listen, I think.
That's right. Yes, it will. Everything will talk to you. In fact, I look upon writing as a conversation. I think that's the best way to think of it. It's like you're talking, you're having a conversation with someone you really like, You know how it is when you have a conversation with someone you like? You don't know what they're going to say, but you know you're going to enjoy talking to them. You know what I mean?
Well, it should be. It should be that interesting. I mean, I think that's the goal is to have. I sat in a den in a house in Brentwood, California, with this woman who was she was my first agent, and her husband had been a screenwriter, and she was remarkable, and she told me, she says, there are no throwaway lines. Every word needs to further the plot. If you think of, that was news to me. Because sometimes I just needed to eat up some time for the next thing to happen, and that's not what you do. So everything has to be compelling from all the dialogue, all the narrative. So it is a big conversation, and to hold your reader's interest, it has to be interesting.
Yeah, you have to hold. But to hold your reader's interest, I think you also have to hold your own interest, you know?
Oh yeah.
Don't you? You've got to stay. You've got to. That's one of the beauties of writing that I've learned over the years is that the best way to keep to inspire my readers, because I try to inspire. That's one of my goals, you know, is to inspire myself. That's the surest way to know I have a chance of inspiring someone else is to find myself inspired, to make myself laugh, to make my that I'm my best teacher in that regard, my best audience in that regard. But you got to interest yourself, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, and it's I can't expect the audience, my readers, to have an emotional response to a scene if I don't. So
yeah,
that's easy. I mean, that's my job description is to keep people up past their bedtime, and if they're bored, that's putting that bookmark in there and closing the thing up is easy. But and I don't want that. I want them to be looking over, going, "Oh man, if I can get to the end now, you know, I can get 5 hours of sleep." And that's my job
that's
description.
Your job. It is your job description. And are you someone who loved, before you started writing fiction, did you love to read suspense? Was that your favorite genre?
Yes. I mean, I started, like a lot of us, I started with the Hardy Boys. And
yes, so did I!
Reread them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd love,
yeah.
Still love all those. And
yep.
And then I think one of the big lessons I got was I was probably in high school and I read Raise the Titanic by Clive Cussler.
Oh yeah.
And
Clive was our first interview.
Really?
Believe it or not.
He's an interesting guy. And
he is an interesting guy.
But he taught me just from that book. I learned it's like, you know what? Go big or go home.
Right.
And he raised the Titanic, but at that point the Titanic hadn't even been found. So,
right.
And it's like, you know, if you can make stuff up that is so compelling and so believable, if you can get and just make up 80% of it, but do it in a way that people are like, huh, then that sounds like fun. So,
yeah,
I learned a lot from those early books. But yeah, I've always been a reader.
See, you know what I love about that? It's a good note to end on, which is that, you know, I think I teach writing of a sort. I like doing it. I think it's a great way to teach people how to make something on purpose, which is always useful, whether you're starting a business or writing a book or having a relationship, whatever it is. But what I love about that story you just told is that I think you can learn however you want to learn. And I think if you find a book you love, it can teach you so much if you look upon it in the correct way. I think the books we love can teach us so much about writing before we even sit down to write, if we use the experience of reading them correctly. And it sounds like you were prepping yourself for that a little bit.
You know, a little bit, without really understanding, because then I went back when I decided I wanted to maybe write seriously. I went back to those books, and I went back to one of my favorites. It was When the Lion Feeds, which was Wilbur Smith's first book. And there's an opening scene in that book that is still captivates me. And
yeah.
I did go back and read those books, and they do have a lot to say.
Well, Phil, we're almost to the end of our time here. And
wow.
So instead of asking my normal question, which I do, because I've asked it to you a couple times, I want to ask you a different question, which is that you're on book number, Seconds to Midnight is book number 7, as I mentioned at the outset of the show. But if you could go back to the somewhat younger Phil, who's just publishing his first book, what advice would you give him now that he did? What do you know now that he didn't know then that you could? What advice could you give him?
I did not know when I was writing my first book, which was Category 5, that it was going to be a series. I didn't know that I could even publish 2 books. And the one thing I did in that book, and it fit the story, and I've complained about it for 15 years, but I gave my hero and his then girlfriend a baby. So not only did my characters have to go out and save the world, I had to figure out daycare before they could go.
Oh, God.
And that has just haunted me book after book. And now
you can't
now
kill the kid off.
Six. Well, you can't do that. You can't do that. But you could, you know, and she's a little too young to go to boarding school, but she's six
right
now. So she's a speaking character, so I can do something with that. But
oh, wow.
Man, I would have given that some thought as to exactly what do I want to be writing about if I have to write three of these, let alone eight.
Right. Right.
So
So funny. You can't know. You can't know the future. Maybe
nope.
There's going to be some fantastic plot point to come where that kid is going to be the perfect foil for whatever. You never know. There might yet be some use.
Well,
you
I told my
predict
son.
Now.
I told my son, who is not a writer, though he's better at it than I ever was at his age. I said you can write the Abigail Nash series. Just start when she's 25 years old, and off you go. I've built the foundation, and just have at it. You're welcome.
Well, if he writes that and I'm still doing this, I'll have him on the show.
There we go. I like it.
Okay, so the book is Seconds to Midnight, available where all fine books are sold, yes?
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Phil, it is always great to have you on the show. Congratulations on your continued success, and I can't wait for book number eight.
Well, yeah, me either. You know, I'm having fun selling this one, and good luck with all your books and workshops. You've got a lot to say. People would be wise to come and listen to you.
Oh, thank you. I do have a lot to say. That is definitely true. Oh, Phil, well, thank you so much, and I hope I get to see you again soon.
Me too. Take care.
All right, take it easy. The name of the book is Seconds to Midnight, and he's a good writer. If you like suspense, I highly recommend you check it out. I will be back next week talking to Ann Tucker about how to live on purpose. And again, in 2 weeks, I'll be doing Fearless Writing. But until then, people, go out there and just do what you love. Read what you love. Talk to who you love. Can't go wrong.